It's Tuesday, June 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a U.S. politician with a famous last name enters the 2016 race for the White House.
Very intensive monitoring in the next 2 weeks is essential to know and to establish whether the current downward momentum will be maintained.
Is South Korea gaining control of a deadly respiratory virus? Also ahead, the cost of fighting terrorism is high, but some say very worth it. And the winner of the first American Idol contest is still winning on the music charts. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. A very high-profile candidate has joined the presidential race for the White House in 2016. Voters now have many choices, but this candidate is sure to draw a lot of attention in the coming months. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti has been watching the announcement just made in Miami, Florida. Carolyn, we of course are talking about...
Jeb Bush is the new man, the former Florida governor. He served 8 years as Florida governor, and now he says he wants to be president. He would be the third Bush as president.
Wow, and that sets up a potential Bush-Clinton campaign. We've seen this before.
And that's what some pundits are saying. Do we want to have history repeat itself? And incidentally, they are throwing stones at each other that same way. Bush today said, we need to fix America, but not by someone who has already had that chance, inferring that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State under President Obama, did have that chance. We need somebody new. But then talking to pundits, some say that a third Bush is one too many, and some say a second Clinton is one too many. So we're left with those types of choices. Will that mean that somebody else comes to the forefront? Maybe they negate each other's candidacy. Who knows?
Interesting. Now, apparently a clear strategy has already come out front as to the type of voter that Bush is going after.
Absolutely. Here we thought that he was going to distance himself in his announcement from his father and his brother who served terms in the White House. But instead, he's setting himself up to be the Hispanic candidate. He's truly playing toward the Hispanic voters. He started out with three singers who sang in Spanish, and they are the Chirino singers. They are the three daughters of a very famous Cuban singer, Willie Chirino. Also, he had speakers before he announced his candidacy come to the stage, and they spoke in Spanish. He spoke in Spanish. Of course, he's married to Columbo Bush, and he met her in Mexico, so learned to speak fluent Spanish because of his wife. They've been married for years. She was his only girlfriend. They're the only girlfriend he's ever known.
Wow. And perhaps first lady one day. We'll have to see. Interesting that his logo just says Jeb 2016. Now, there's some interesting conversation about that, too.
You are so right, Jim. People say, where's the last name? Where's the Bush name? Does that mean he's trying to set himself apart from his brother and his father? It just has Jeb in bold red letters with an exclamation mark. And the question then is, does that mean that he is saying, I'm definitely conservative with that exclamation mark? And then underneath, in navy blue, 2016.
Always fun to watch politics, especially when politicians are trying to position themselves and distance themselves and bring themselves closer. And it's a very interesting tightrope that Jeb Bush is walking between history and trying to define his own image.
Absolutely. But you can also say the same about Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
Her logo is just an H with an arrow. So where's the
pointing to the right?
Exactly. Good point.
Carolyn Pursuti, certainly a lot more for you to watch as the campaign rolls on. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's all fun. Glad to be here.
The 62-year-old Bush has raised tens of millions of dollars for his campaign and was initially thought to be the leading Republican contender, but recent national political opinion surveys show him virtually deadlocked with two other candidates. They are Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who has joined the contest, and also Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has yet to officially announce. Other Republicans are not too far behind in the pre-election polling. We wanted to see what was happening online with you and the response out in social media. And so Michael Lippin is with me in the studio.
Hey,
hi, Michael.
Hi, yes. Well, Jeb Bush is already getting a boost to his social media following after making his big announcement today. His Twitter account, at Jeb Bush, was at 197,000 followers a few hours ago, and now it's surpassed 200,000, so that's a little boost there. On Facebook, he had 186,000 followers when I last checked, but that is still way behind one of his main rivals for the Republican nomination, his fellow Floridian U.S. Senator Marco Rubio. Now, Rubio has 879,000 Facebook followers and 747,000 Twitter fans. Now, you would expect Rubio to have a bigger social media presence, considering that he is a serving U.S. senator and that he's already been in the presidential race for 2 months. Whereas Bush hasn't been in office for 8 years, and he's relatively little known outside of Florida, where he served as a state governor. You know, those two Floridians did, however, engage in some friendly banter on Twitter earlier Monday. Rubio used his Twitter account to wish the new candidate well, saying, "My friend Jeb Bush is a passionate advocate for what he believes, and I welcome him to the race." Bush, who like Rubio is from Miami, had a pretty gracious response, tweeting, "Thanks, Marco. Glad I can do it in our hometown. See you out there." Now, whether they'll still be as pleasant as that to each other, you know, as the going gets tough in the presidential campaign, we'll have to wait and see.
Definitely. And I think it's interesting that his Twitter handle has his last name in it, Jeb Bush. I guess Jeb was already taken.
I don't think, he could avoid that, really.
So how much attention is Jeb Bush getting out there on Twitter?
Yeah, quite a lot. Easily the most attention that he's had in the past month. Analytics website Topsy shows that Jeb Bush's name has been tweeted about 50,000 times in the last 24 hours. Some of the most common hashtags that people have been using to talk about him on Twitter include hashtag Jeb Bush, that's all one word, and also hashtag Jeb2016, his official campaign name. But I've also seen some other Bush-related hashtags get attention today. One that Bush won't necessarily like is the hashtag No More Bushes. Now, that's been used about 20,000 times in the past day, and it's been a popular way for people who don't like Bush to point out his relation to the other two recent U.S. presidents, of course, his father George H.W. Bush and his brother George W. Bush. Another hashtag that also started getting more frequently used today is a kind of reaction to No More Bushes. Perhaps inevitably, it's called hashtag No More Clintons. And I've seen some people use both hashtags in the same tweet, Jen.
Well, I think they're going to get both more of Bush and Clinton in the coming months. It seems
Maybe.
To be unavoidable. Michael, thanks so much for stopping by. Please be sure to follow Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm there too at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The South Korean Health Ministry has announced 5 new cases of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome and 2 more deaths. That raises the death toll to 16 and the total number of cases to 150 since the outbreak was first detected on May 20th. All cases have been traced so far to health facilities. Thousands are being quarantined, and the health crisis forced the closure of schools and businesses and cut by tens of thousands the number of tourists in Asia's fourth largest economy. The outbreak has raised alarms in other Asian countries. China says it's cutting flights to South Korea, stepping up the monitoring of fever and pneumonia cases, and calling on provincial capitals and port cities to identify specific hospitals to handle suspected MERS cases. However, after reviewing the outbreak for a week, experts from the World Health Organization said there's no evidence to suggest that the virus is spreading beyond the South Korean healthcare facilities. Malik Pierce is a virologist at the University of Hong Kong, and he told VOA's Victor Beatty South Korean health authorities have, in the last 10 days, greatly enhanced their control measures.
In concordance with that, we do see the number of new cases declining, and together with that, the enhanced quarantine measures, including no-fly lists that people are being put on, much stronger than what was in place at the early stages of the outbreak. So taking all that together, I think the risks of the virus spilling out of Korea is reduced. It is not zero by any means, but it is reduced. Very intensive monitoring in the next 2 weeks is essential to know and to establish whether the current downward momentum will be maintained.
How would you equate this to the 2002-2003 outbreak of the what was called severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, which began in China and killed about 800 people?
It is a related virus, but what we are seeing now is what was happening back in November and December 2002, long before anyone knew anything was going on. And this is looking at it in retrospect, right? After SARS had emerged and spread, and when detailed investigations were done, we realized that in November and December 2002, there were clusters of SARS cases occurring in individual cities in the Guangdong province in southern China. These were emerging and disappearing by themselves without necessarily particular control measures. So it was like sort of minor explosions taking place here and there, which were contained and nobody took much notice of it until in February, when one particular cluster did adapt to more efficient human-to-human transmission, and then it came through Hong Kong, and through Hong Kong it spread worldwide. So we haven't come to that stage of that worldwide spread at the moment. We are at the stage of having these clusters of infection. And mind you, Korea is not the only place where such clusters of infection and outbreaks are taking place. I mean, last year we had two quite big clusters of transmission. In fact, each of them bigger than the South Korean outbreak that we are seeing now in Saudi Arabia, one in Jeddah and one in Riyadh. So there are these clusters of MERS transmissions appearing. Up to now, they have been controllable. Because they have been primarily transmitted within hospital settings. And that is crucial because we are not seeing any transmission in the community. Now, as long as it is like that, it is controllable as it was controlled in Jeddah and in Riyadh. But I think what one cannot take for granted is that at some point that this virus might not change in a way to become more transmissible. Now, it has not done that as far as one can see in South Korea at the moment, but you have to keep in mind that the pot is kind of brewing in the Middle East because the virus is there in the animal host, which primarily is the camel, and it's jumping from time to time to humans and sometimes causing these large outbreaks.
Pierce also says transmission is usually through coughing or sneezing by an infected person or picked up through touching surfaces such as tabletops. There is no known vaccine or treatment for MERS, and its fatality rate has reached nearly 41%. This is VOA's International Edition. The battle against Islamic State has been largely measured by occupation or loss of territory, along with the success of airstrikes and other tactics. VOA's Jeff Selden follows developments at the Pentagon, and he joins us to discuss another aspect of the fight, and that's cost. Jeff, 1 year into this, the Defense Department is dealing with some big monetary numbers.
Yeah, I mean, the Defense Department said late last week that as of now, the U.S. has spent about $2.74 billion on its operations to counter the growth of the Islamic State, both in Iraq and in Syria. And when you average that out, that comes to about $9.1 million a day. That's up significantly from what it was when the campaign started as well. And Pentagon officials say in part that's because initially the U.S. operations were focused only on Iraq. It's then been expanded into Syria. And so now there are more sorties, more operations flying, more planes in the air. Sometimes they're looking for targets. Sometimes they know what targets they want to hit. But all that has helped to increase the cost as the campaign has gone on.
Well, the Pentagon does consider that money well spent, noting some good results from the campaigns.
Yeah, the Pentagon says that it has worked out so far, noting, first of all, this was never going to be a quick and easy operation. Pentagon officials have said all along that it could take 3 years, maybe more, to, in the words of the president, to degrade and ultimately to defeat the Islamic State. They also point out that since the air campaign started, the Islamic State has been rolled back from about 25% of the territory it once held in Iraq, and that key cities and towns, places like Tikrit, Sinjar, Amerli, Kobani, which were taken by the Islamic State, have now been taken back by forces on the ground, in large part due to the help of the U.S. air support.
Now, I understand these numbers don't reflect just the degradation of ISIS positions, but also for some training.
Well, actually, that's one of the areas where it doesn't exactly reflect that. And that's why there are a number of people who are looking at these numbers with a lot of concern and even suggesting perhaps there's some mission creep and that the numbers are only going to grow. Because these are numbers that are for the U.S. air operations, for the bombing runs that they go on, for the surveillance that they do from the air. But in terms of training and in terms of there's a fund for training, the Iraqi troops, retraining them, that's not been added into these costs. And that's approximately $1.6 billion for what's known as the Train and Equip program. And that's just for the Iraqi forces. Remember, the U.S. has also done some Train and Equip programming formerly through the intelligence community, notably the CIA, with some of the rebels in Syria. And there's been talk of trying to get a Train and Equip program up off the ground for Syrian fighters, Syrian rebel fighters, and those fighters are still being vetted. They haven't even gone through training yet. So what critics say is that there's plenty of room for these costs to expand even more, and they wonder how easy it will be to contain the costs when, perhaps, in their view, the Obama administration has not clearly defined the objectives in terms of what the military is supposed to accomplish on the ground, step by step, how that happens.
Continuing costs of the Pentagon and always some great continuing reporting from there. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Anytime.
This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Kelly Clarkson has some new music out, and David Byrd and Larry London are in our studio.
She won the very first American Idol, and now Kelly Clarkson has a new song that's climbing the charts. It's called Invincible. It's from her new CD, Piece by Piece, and Larry London joins me to talk about this tune. Larry,
well,
this is another anthem from Kelly Clarkson, I guess.
She's very good at creating music that people can relate to and connect with, and that's one of the keys to her success over the years. And the new album is great, Piece by Piece. She took an off-road for a little bit, did some country music, but she's kind of back in the main lane of the pop world, and just finished off with a Heartbeat song, which was her 16th top 40 single. And so the new song, Invincible, as you mentioned, it's an inspirational song. It's a very happy, positive song. And Kelly's in a very positive place right now, despite all of the criticism that she's been undergoing recently because of her weight gain. And so she's okay. She's happy with herself. She says, I love myself, and I am invincible, which is what this song kind of reflects and represents.
You know I was broke down. I hit the ground. I was crying out. I couldn't make no sound. No one hears the silent tears collected. You know I had lost hope. I was all alone. Never been.
Now, she had a baby, right? That's
yeah.
why she had some weight gain.
Well, she's always battled weight. That's been a problem that she's dealt with her entire life. She admits openly that the weight issues have always been troublesome for her. She did drop a few pounds a number of years ago, but since the baby, since the birth of River Rose, it has not been a very easy thing for her to get rid of the weight. But she's happy with herself, as she said. In fact, she said after she finishes her current tour, she's going to try and get pregnant again. She wants to have another baby by the end of this year. She wants to be pregnant.
And this song talks about, you know, issues like overcoming abuse. The video for it has different women in different scenarios. One woman is in a wheelchair. One woman is, like, in an abusive situation, you know, and it's different ethnicities, different races, et cetera. And is Kelly trying to broaden her appeal with the video, or what exactly is she doing there?
Well, that's an interesting question, David. Kelly, you know, currently appeals to quite a diverse group of people to begin with. They all like her and relate to her. She's a person who's overcome a number of obstacles, as we mentioned a little while ago. She grew up in a very small town in Texas, and they weren't very wealthy. Mom was an English teacher. And so, you know, she's considers herself to be the average kind of person. She doesn't look at herself as a star. She thinks her music is very relatable, and she's very reachable. She's very reachable. She's not kind of up on a perch or anything like that. She wants to be an everybody's person, and I think she comes across that way. You really like Kelly. She's genuine with everything she does. 25 million sales. She's won so many awards, including 12 Billboard Music Awards. So, you know, she's got the appeal that is necessary to make it in the music business these days. And the new song is doing very well. She performed it for the first time on television at the Billboard Award Show.
David Byrd and Larry London, who drop by often in our studios, thank you. And we thank you for listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The most important document in British history celebrates its 800th birthday this month, one being marked in our nation, too, for providing a foundation for our government and liberties. In a meadow by the Thames River near London on June 15th, in the year 1215, the English King John sued for peace with a group of rebellious nobles by attaching his royal seal to a Great Charter of Liberties, better known by its title in Latin, the Magna Carta. By most accounts, John was a horrible monarch. He imposed heavy taxes, far higher than those of kings before him. When someone couldn't pay, he took their sons hostage. Those suspected of disloyalty were executed without trial. For interfering with affairs of the church, he was excommunicated. Powerless in the face of open rebellion, and anxious to save his throne, John conceded to a list of 63 grievances, and promised from then on to obey the law of the land. Future kings would be bound by the charter as well, he pledged. Many of its provisions are irrelevant today, dealing as they do with such things as feudal laws regarding rents and inheritance. But with its implication that the head of state is subject to the rule of law, and the declaration that all people have a right to a fair trial if accused of a crime, the Magna Carta has become a symbol of liberty, individual freedoms, and the rule of law around the world. Some four centuries later, when English colonists left for the New World, they brought royal charters that established their colonies, each couched with the guarantees of rights and liberties implied by the Magna Carta. And later, when the colonists fought for independence from Britain, they were fighting not so much for rights unknown, but to preserve those rights and liberties now laid out in our Constitution. Magna Carta still forms an important symbol of liberty today. It is the foundation of freedom of the individual against arbitrary authority, and the notion that no one, not even a king, is above the law.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America in Washington. Today on the program, we report on the life of some of the tens of thousands of refugees who are returning to Afghanistan from Pakistan. They are suffering because they have no jobs, no support, and no place to live.
So this has caused a major strain on the resources of the government and IOM to provide assistance to these people.
And we will tell you about a man who has spent the past 10 years collecting more than a million secrets from people around the world. We asked him why he did it.
I was struggling with secrets in my own life.
Then you will hear Jonathan Evans' weekly technology report. This week, he tells us about a device that will gather data about building interiors. It will give architects, engineers, and building supervisors information that once took weeks to measure and process.
The backpack is something you can wear which has a lot of sensors on the back, which can then walk through a building and detect the geometry, the lights, the plug load, and once you take it out, you can create a 3D model.
And later, as always, we will present the making of a nation. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Many of the tens of thousands of people returning to Afghanistan from Pakistan have no jobs, no support, and no home. International aid agencies say they and the government are unable to help many of them. Hadisa is one of those who has returned, along with her family. She is 14 years old, but she appears older. She cares for her mother, who is ill, and for her younger brother. He is abused at the place where he works. Her father and other family members together earn less than $40 a month. They must pay half of that to the owner of the house in which they live.
We only eat bread with tea and pay rent. We cannot afford anything else.
Hadisa is one of more than 70,000 refugees who have returned to Afghanistan this year from Pakistan. Her mother says she does not know how they will survive.
Because of migration, our life has gone from bad to worse. In Pakistan, we were in trouble due to a lack of legal documents. Here, we have no money.
Pakistan began taking action against undocumented Afghan refugees after an attack on a school in which 150 people were killed, most of them children. Matthew Graydon works at the International Organization of Migration. He says aid agencies and the Afghan government were not prepared for the large increase in the number of people returning to the country.
So this has caused a major strain on the resources of the government and IOM to provide assistance to these people.
Many of the families that have returned to Afghanistan had been living in Pakistan for many years. Some of the children in those families were born in Pakistan. They have never been to Afghanistan. The families return to communities where they often do not know many people. Many arrive with just the clothes they are wearing. The lack of funding means only those most in need are given help by the government or aid agencies. The rest, like the family VOA spoke with, must find food and shelter by themselves. For the refugee family we spoke with, life in Pakistan was difficult. But it is much worse in Afghanistan, and they do not believe it will change. Some people collect postage stamps, the small pieces of paper you place on letters or postcards before mailing them. Other people collect works of art, antiques, or musical instruments. But a man in the American state of Maryland collects secrets. For the past 10 years, people from throughout the world have been sending Frank Warren postcards and other objects with secrets written on them. He now has a million secrets.
Is a drawing of an elevator, and the secret says, "I feel guilty when I take elevators for one floor, so I limp when I get out."
Mr. Warren lives in Germantown, Maryland, near Washington, D.C. 10 years ago, he created an art project he calls Post Secret.
I invited strangers from all around the world to write down their deepest confession on a postcard, something they'd never told anyone else before, but something that was true. And I asked them to mail it to my home anonymously.
People send him postcards, other objects, and emails telling their secrets. Every Sunday, he chooses 10 secrets and puts them on the Post Secret website, postsecret.com.
The way I choose to see it is someone is finally finding the strength and courage to make their heart vulnerable.
Mr. Warren says he created Post Secret so people would have a safe place in which to share their secrets.
I was struggling with secrets in my own life, and it was by creating this safe place where others could share their secrets with me without judgment, anonymously. I think that space was something I needed just as much as they did.
He has published 6 books full of the secrets people have shared with him. 1 secret in each book is his. The project itself was once one of Mr. Warren's secrets. His wife, Jan, did not know exactly what he was doing until the first book was published.
The publisher actually called me and told me that the address was going to be on the book. And I said, "No, it's not." And she said, "Yes, it is. It's in the contract." And I said, "No, it's not." I mean, I wasn't very happy at all about that.
Some people tell Frank Warren of their secret desire to kill themselves. So he and the Post Secret community have raised more than $1 million to help prevent suicides. Now, our weekly look at the latest technology news. Architects, engineers, and building supervisors will soon be able to quickly collect information that once took weeks to measure and process. Scientists have developed a device to gather information about building interiors, the design and exact measurements of a building. The scientists are with the University of California, Berkeley. Their invention connects to a backpack. The device requires only one pass through a building to create a three-dimensional or 3D model of the structure. In other words, the model shows an object's height, width, and depth. The device also is able to collect other valuable information related to the building's energy usage. Our technology correspondent Jonathan Evans has more on this invention.
An older building may need a new, more efficient heating and cooling system. Experts say the first thing you need to know is the exact shape of all rooms in the building. You have to consider the size and position of heating and cooling equipment, windows, and doors. Another consideration is the placement of electrical outlets, the areas where electrically operated equipment can be connected to the power supply. Annie Marston is with Bauman Consulting, the business that developed the new device. She says that instead of using a team of experts with laptop computers and other devices, it will soon be possible to send only one person with a space-age backpack.
The backpack is something you can wear which has a lot of sensors on the back, which can then walk through a building and detect the geometry, the lights, the plug load. And once you take it out, you can create a 3D model, which can show an IR image of the walls and look at the thermal capacity of the building. And then it can be transferred into an energy model, and that energy model can be run and look at how the energy is dispersed within the building, and that's where we can start looking at saving measures and things like that.
Weather experts use a scientific instrument called a barometer to measure pressure in Earth's atmosphere. But the device uses a barometer to estimate height. Instruments called magnetometers act as 3D compasses. They gather information about metallic structures. The University of California scientists say they can create a virtual map with an accuracy of plus or minus 10 centimeters. They say the device uses a mathematical problem to add surfaces to the walls and floors. This can be used for architectural design or to run tests on energy usage. Annie Marston says the device may be very useful to energy testers and engineers, but also to builders and the construction industry. When they are building a new construction, it will be great to have a model of the ducts and the pipes before the walls are closed up, so in later years, you know where everything is, she says. Researchers say they are now working to lower the weight of the backpack from 15 to about 10 kilograms. But the price of the device is about $20,000. Researchers predict the device will be available for loan at a much lower price. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. The Making of a Nation is coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington.
This is Rich Kleinfeld. And this is Stan Busby with The Making of a Nation, a VOA special English program about the history of the United States. Today, we continue the story of President John Kennedy.
John Kennedy began his administration in 1961 with great energy to do good things. After just 3 months in office, however, he had to take responsibility for a big failure. On April 17th, Cuban exiles, trained by America's Central Intelligence Agency, invaded Cuba. Their goal was to overthrow Cuba's communist leader, Fidel Castro. Most of the exiles were killed or captured. The last administration had planned the invasion, but Kennedy had approved it. After the incident, some Americans wondered if he had enough experience to lead the nation. Some asked themselves if the 43-year-old Kennedy was too young to be president after all.
Kennedy soon regained some public approval when he visited French leader General Charles de Gaulle. The French were very interested in the new American president. They were even more interested in his beautiful wife. The president said, with a laugh, that he was the man who had come to Paris with Jacqueline Kennedy.
In Vienna, Kennedy met with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. Their relations would always be difficult. Khrushchev did not want to compromise on any issue. He threatened to have the East Germans block all movement into and out of the western part of the city of Berlin. Not long after, the East Germans, with Soviet support, built a wall to separate the eastern and western parts of the city. President Kennedy quickly announced a large increase in the number of American military forces in Germany. He said the United States would not permit freedom to end in Berlin.
About a year later, in October 1962, President Kennedy said the United States had discovered that the Soviets were putting nuclear missiles in Cuba. He took several actions to protest the deployment. One was to send American ships to the area. They were to prevent Soviet ships from taking missile parts and related supplies to the Cuban government. In a speech broadcast on television, Kennedy spoke about the seriousness of the situation.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States.
No fighting broke out between the United States and the Soviet Union because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Soviet ships carrying missile parts to Cuba turned back, and President Kennedy promised that the United States would not invade Cuba if the Soviet Union removed its missiles and stopped building new ones there. The two sides did, however, continue their Cold War of words and influence. In Asia, the Soviet Union continued to provide military, economic, and technical aid to communist governments. The Kennedy administration fought communism in Vietnam by increasing the number of American military advisors there.
The United States and the Soviet Union did make some progress on arms control, however. In 1963, the two countries reached a major agreement to ban tests of nuclear weapons above ground, underwater, and in space. The treaty did not ban nuclear tests under the ground. On national issues, President Kennedy supported efforts to guarantee a better life for African Americans. One man who pushed for changes was his younger brother, Robert. Robert Kennedy was Attorney General and head of the Justice Department at that time.
The Justice Department took legal action against Southern states that violated the Voting Rights Acts of 1957 and 1960. The administration also supported a voter registration campaign among African Americans. The campaign helped them to record their names with election officials so they could vote. As Attorney General, Robert Kennedy repeatedly called on National Guard troops to protect black citizens from crowds of angry white citizens. Incidents took place when blacks tried to register to vote and when they tried to attend white schools.
President Kennedy said the situation was causing a moral crisis in America. He decided it was time to propose a new civil rights law. The measure would guarantee equal treatment for blacks in public places and in jobs. It would speed the work of ending racial separation in schools. Kennedy wanted the new legislation badly, but Congress delayed action. It did not pass a broad civil rights bill until 1964, after his presidency.
In November 1963, Kennedy left Washington for the state of Texas. He hoped to help settle a local dispute in his Democratic Party. The dispute might have affected chances for his re-election in 1964. He arrived in the city of Dallas in the late morning of November 22nd. Dallas was known to be a center of opposition to Kennedy, yet many people waited to see him.
A parade of cars traveled through the streets of Dallas. Kennedy and his wife were in the back seat of one. Their car had no top, so everyone could see them easily. Another car, filled with Secret Service security agents, was next to the president's. Suddenly, there were gunshots. Then, many Americans heard this emergency report from television newsman Walter Cronkite.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The cars raced to Parkland Memorial Hospital, but doctors there could do little. 30 minutes later, reporters, including Walter Cronkite, broadcast this announcement.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. As the nation mourned, police searched for the person who had killed John Kennedy. They arrested a man named Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald worked in a building near the place where Kennedy had been shot. People had seen him leave the building after the shooting. He had a gun.
Lee Harvey Oswald was a man with a strange past. He was a former United States Marine. He was also a communist. He had lived for a while in the Soviet Union and had tried to become a Soviet citizen. He worked for a committee that supported the communist government in Cuba. Police questioned Oswald about the death of President Kennedy. He said he did not do it. After 2 days, officials decided to move him to a different jail.
As they did, television cameras recorded the death of Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald was being led by two police officials. Suddenly, a man stepped in front of them. There was a shot, and Oswald fell to the floor. The gunman was Jack Ruby. He owned an eating and drinking place in Dallas. He said he killed Oswald to prevent the Kennedy family from having to live through a trial.
President Kennedy's body had been returned to Washington. After a state funeral, he was buried in Arlington National Cemetery across the Potomac River. A gas flame burns at his burial place day and night. An official committee was formed to investigate his death. It was headed by the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, and was known as the Warren Commission. In its report, the Warren Commission said that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. It said there was no plot to kill the president.
Many Americans did not accept the report. They believed there was a plot. Some blamed Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Some blamed extremists in America's Central Intelligence Agency. Others blamed organized crime. The truth of what happened to John Kennedy may be what was stated in the Warren Commission report, that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Or, perhaps, the complete truth may never be known.
This program of The Making of a Nation was written by Jerry Watson and produced by Paul Thompson. This is Rich Kleinfeld.
And this is Stan Busby. Join us again next week for another VOA Special English program about the history of the United States. Thank you.